You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
James Rebanks has illustrated his latest book, A Shepherd's View, with color photographs that chronicle the daily life of the shepherding community of the English Lake District. The images capture the community's year-long activities, such as its competitive sheep shows, pastoral baking competitions, and the roles dogs play in keeping a flock intact. It's published by Flatiron. Shepherding is a subject Mr. Rebanks knows intimately because he runs his family-owned farm in the region. And when he's not tending to his sheep, he is busy tweeting from @Herdy Shepherd.
Herdy Shepherd 1, yeah.
Or he serves as an expert advisor on sustainable tourism for UNESCO. His previous book, The Shepherd's Life, was a New York Times bestseller. I'm very pleased it has brought James Rebanks to our show today. Hello.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for inviting me to New York. It's an amazing place.
Ah, so this is the first time you've been here?
It's the first time I've been to America.
Wow. Well, you know, we do have sheep in America as well. But I wonder if shepherding is at all similar here. Will you be finding out?
The truth is, I need to find out. I haven't seen many sheep since I got to America. I've been in Chicago for a couple of days, and then I came to New York. But I'm guessing, because I don't know about American shepherding, but certainly our shepherding is a really, really ancient tradition. So many of the things that we still do on the farm are at least 1,000 years old. So.
And how long has your family been in the shepherding business?
My sister did our family tree to try and work that out about 5 years ago, and she got the paperwork back about 600 years, and then there is no paperwork older than that, so we assume we were there for much longer than that.
Usually with families, they go back that long. Somebody decides wants to go to law school or become a teacher.
Or leave for America, maybe.
That happened in your family?
I think there are some people with our surname in America, so maybe somebody did. But no, we have my family's story is probably the exact opposite of the story of the people that came to America. We're the people who stuck, who stayed in the place and loved the place so much and managed to hold on in that place, and we didn't leave.
Isn't the Lake District usually associated with early 19th century lake poets like William Wordsworth and Samuel Coleridge? Were the sheep always there along with the poets?
The sheep have always been there, probably for about 4,000 or 5,000 years. When I was growing up, I thought Wordsworth just wrote about daffodils and then sort of wandering lonely as a cloud. But it turns out actually Wordsworth wrote about the shepherds. He wrote these amazing poems a couple of hundred years ago about shepherds and sheep.
And although the Lake District isn't a large area, it receives 16 million tourists a year, yeah. I'm assuming mostly because they want to go to the Wordsworth house and see some of the things that those poets wrote about.
Yeah, well, actually, when those tourists are asked, when they survey them, they come because they love the landscape. So it's one of the most beautiful cultural landscapes on earth, a sort of man-made, woman-made landscape.
What's more important to the local economy, sheep or tourism?
Financially, tourism. And tourism has probably been worth more economically than sheep for a very long time. But the culture of the place, the way of life of the indigenous people, if you like, is about sheep and shepherding.
And you write that the district inspired important ideas about nature.
Yeah, the first place, the first written record of any kind of anybody talking about a national park was in the Lake District, because William Wordsworth said that it was so beautiful and so special it should belong to everybody who had an eye to see and a heart to feel. And he said it should be a kind of national park. And later the Americans actually developed national parks and have them for real before we do, but that's probably where the idea comes from.
But isn't it protected by the National Trust?
Parts of it are. So parts of it were left by writers like Beatrix Potter. She made all her money from the Peter Rabbit books, and she bought a lot of farms. I think she bought 14 farms, and she left them to the National Trust. But it isn't a state-owned landscape. A lot of it belongs to individual families, farming families.
The Lake District is the largest area of common land in Western Europe. How much common land exists in the world these days?
Less and less. So ours is a sort of rare survival of a common land. So if you can imagine this in the valley bottoms, we have privately owned fields, but the actual mountains themselves don't belong to any of us. We have grazing rights to take a certain number of sheep to the mountain.
And you were totally spared of the Industrial Revolution?
No. In fact, the really interesting thing is the Industrial Revolution happens about 2 hours' drive down the road. So ours is the first landscape on Earth where people start to defend beautiful things and old things against the Industrial Revolution.
The photographs in your book are stunning, Did you edit them to only include fair weather shots, although there's a lot of threatening clouds in the skies?
There are a couple of pictures in there of really lousy days, because the truth is, if you're a shepherd, you're out all winter. You're in some of the worst weather.
Snow?
Snow and rain. And there are pictures of that in there, but it's quite difficult to take pictures of rain and snow, to be honest. But there are pictures of my father in there on a rainy day, sort of working on the land and moving sheep, and that's part of it. And in my first book, The Shepherd's Life, I wanted to write a very no-frills, unromantic account of it, so I wrote about the work and the working people.
Well, that was more of an autobiography.
It was a memoir, and I wrote somewhere in that I wanted to write the history of the nobodies, the people that nobody ever mentions, the working people that make landscapes, make cities, and that was the ethos behind writing the book. I wanted to celebrate those people.
We were just talking with Tracy Ullman about regional accents, and you write that the shepherds are descendants of the Vikings and that you switch codes between your own dialect and the Queen's English. Yeah. Can you give us an example of the shepherd's style?
Yeah, so we have our own way of counting. So if you count to five in our dialect, it would be Yan Tan Tethra Medra Pip. We call it
gay. And where would that come
from? Some of it comes from sort of Anglo-Saxon speech patterns, but a lot of our words, a lot of our dialect is almost pure Norse. So we call a gate a yat. We call the iron bar that you make a hole to put your fence posts into the ground a gaeblick. We call a mole, a creature that lives under the earth that comes up, we call it a maudie warp or a maudie.
And you call a ram a tup.
We call a ram a tup. Our dialect is actually understood better in Norway than it is in London, which I think is amazing.
Doesn't talking about sheep in regular English get complicated because the same word refers to a single animal and a wide range of breeds?
Yeah, it's actually even worse than that, because every time a new wave of language came into Britain, so Norman, Anglo-Saxon, Viking, every wave of invasion into England brought another word for sheep, another word for wool, another word for the meat. So that's why I have sort of mutton, lamb, etc. There's a multitude of words that come from those different linguistic traditions.
To the uninitiated, sheep are sheep, but doesn't your community keep flock books of great sheep who have lived there throughout the ages?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I wanted to write about was that I think in a modern industrial sort of farming landscape, sheep are just commodities and nobody worries too much about the individual ones. But if you look at very traditional shepherding communities like ours, the individual sheep are celebrated, the breeding of the sheep is celebrated, how they look is celebrated. So there are traditions in our landscape where we compete with the sheep, and there's very particular ideas have emerged over about 5,000 years. And I said to somebody the other day, the way we think about the sheep is another form of culture. It's like punk or Picasso. It's a real living working culture. It isn't a sort of devalued industrial food system. It has its own values and sort of ways of seeing things.
How are the flocks defined? By the shepherd who breeds them, or by the genetics of the sheep themselves?
The sheep look like they do because of the shepherd's work.
Because it's changed over the years. You include some old photographs here, and there's been a lot of changes in fairly recent times.
Yeah, even without doing any of the stuff that scientists can do now, even in the old days, you can change the look of an animal rapidly. So in the last 100 years, the value of wool of our sheep has crashed dramatically. So through selective breeding, basically choosing a particular kind of tup or ram, you can breed the wool off them. So they have a lot less wool than they used to have on them.
And what do you look for in a good tup? You say that they're worth half a flock.
Yeah, and that's basic maths, because the male sheep can mate with up to 100, 120 females. So if you want to improve your flock, you buy these great rams that cost a lot of money. But what do we look for? Well, we look for two things, really. We look for really practical things. They've got to have really short teeth. They've got to have really tough wool to survive on a mountain.
Why short teeth?
Short teeth last longer. Trust me. If you have really short, tight-knitted teeth, you live longer on a mountain. But as well as those practical things, we're also looking, because it's happened for so long, the culture has emerged around it, we look for a certain colour of sheep, we look for a certain presence, and they become like works of art. And we look for sort of presence and character and style.
I'm speaking with James Rebanks about his latest book, The Shepherd's View, Modern Photographs from an Ancient Landscape. You mentioned that wool isn't as much of a commodity today as it was in the past, but we still have a lot of, we use wool a lot, don't we?
Yeah, but the really tragic thing is we can make plastic clothes, synthetic clothes, cheaper than we can process natural fibers like wool.
But wool is better.
Wool's amazing. When they run the science on wool, it's one of the great products in the world. So we have to rediscover wool, and we have to use it much more, and we have to add value to it, because at the moment, the fleeces of my sheep is worth less than the price of shearing them.
So when you're selling, because you write, shepherding isn't just about tending sheep, it's about breeding sheep for sale.
Yeah.
Are you breeding them for their milk, for their meat, or are you still thinking about the wool?
We're not thinking about the wool very much at all, because it's almost worthless, which is a sad statement, but true. What the mountains actually do in England is the mountains are the nursery for the whole sheep flock, for the whole country. So over the last month, the shepherds from all of the lowland areas in England travel to these sales that spring up overnight in the fields and in the towns of the north of England. And they buy the spare daughters, the ones that aren't needed to renew the flock. They buy them and they take them to lowland England, and they've done that for as long as anybody knows. They may well have done it for 2,000, 3,000 years.
You write that the keenest shepherds become artists at making their sheep beautiful. How do you make a sheep look beautiful?
Well, it isn't sort of...
don't put lipstick on
it. No, not too lipstick, but to give you an example, one of the breeds that we keep is a breed called the Swaledales, which are from Yorkshire, basically. They're from the Yorkshire Dales. And they have a particular look where they have black faces with white spectacles and white noses. And you can cheat.
And they have off-color wool.
Yeah, they have a sort of peaty-colored gray wool.
Curled horns.
Yeah, and curled horns. They're amazing-looking sheep. But you can cheat a little bit. To make the spectacles look cleaner, to make the nose look cleaner, you can pluck out the white hairs out of the black. It's crazy, but that's what people do in our area.
And how do they respond when you're doing this plucking?
Initially, they're probably bamboozled, but the truth is a lot of the sheep that are taken to these shows become they become prima donnas. They love the attention. They love the way that they're looked after, and they have an amazing life. They have an amazing half-wild life, and they're sort of almost worshipped by some of the shepherds, these sheep.
Have you ever judged the shepherd's meat?
Yeah, I've done quite a few. I did one about 3 weeks ago, and you can't judge in your own valley where we live. You would be asked to judge in another valley where you're not considered to be biased. But you take your life into your hands. It's like judging anything else. You're in danger of offending everybody that doesn't win.
But you're looking for the short teeth, but also legs and feet.
Yeah, there's a very particular look that each one of these historic breeds have. And each one's different. So, believe it or not, in England, there are 60, even though England's not very big, there are 60 different regional breeds, heritage breeds, and each one was selectively bred over many, many centuries to suit that particular kind of ground and that particular kind of environment. And each one has its own look. And, the shepherds of those individual breeds are all obsessive about breeding the one that looks the most perfect.
You're right that it pays to have sheep that stand out with a slightly arched Roman nose.
Yeah, I mean the
that's an aesthetic thing.
Some of the people listening, I think, were crazy. But if you're trying to breed the perfect sheep, then you want to breed these sort of very noble-looking creatures that they're very proud, and the great ones strut around a little bit and act a little bit like a great sportsman. When you see somebody hit a home run and then stick their chest out and milk it from the crowd, that's the sort of character that we're looking for in those male sheep.
It seems that shepherding is more than just watching the sheep. You write about a baking competition?
Yeah, we at the shepherd's meet that we have in the autumn, where we all gather together in our valley, some years ago somebody decided it would be fun for the shepherds to compete to see who's the best baker, and it's become hugely competitive. And my father, who sadly we lost, I read about my father in the book, but I lost my father to cancer about 18 months ago. And he was very proud, because he once or twice nearly won that competition. He was second a couple of times, and he made some fantastic bread that he thought was the best bread anybody had ever baked.
But haven't some of the bakers been found cheating?
There was an incident with cheating one year where somebody had got his mother to bake the bread, and he was disqualified, and his name is dirt in our valley now.
Now, you went to Oxford University. Did you study shepherding?
No, I didn't.
I didn't think they taught that course.
No, I didn't. I studied American history. That'll make you laugh, won't it? So I studied things like the Lincoln-Douglas debates and the economic history of America and the way that this city and others like it emerged. These are things that I was interested in. So,
can anyone learn to be a shepherd? Is there a program somewhere?
There isn't. I mean, it's probably quite difficult, because it's a very practical thing. It's like learning to be a carpenter or something. Really what you need to do is to start as young as possible and to commit yourself to it for a very long period of time. So you sort of go through a period of apprenticeship. But yes, humans can learn all sorts of things, so of course they can learn to be a shepherd.
What role do sheepdogs play in sheep farming? You say that All that is good about a sheepdog is based on the instincts of a wolf. And I was kind of surprised because I thought a wolf's instinct was to eat sheep.
So I was careful in my language on that. What we harness with the sheepdogs is the instinct, but stop it turning into the outcome that would happen with a wolf. So wolves are brilliantly intelligent at working as a pack to put prey animals into a certain place and then to attack them. What we do is with the sheepdogs is when they're very young, we harness that instinct, that desire to run around things, that desire to hold them with their eye, as we would call it, and we turn it into something much more harmless. So our dogs would never, ever hurt or bite a sheep, but we're using that same instinct and harnessing it. And
how do you train them?
It takes about 2 years. You start with them when they're about eight weeks old. You start with little simple things, these you do with old dogs, teaching them their name, teaching them some sort of basic discipline. And then over time, you're letting their instinct to chase a sheep, but you're shaping that and turning it into something that you can harness and use. And their importance in our way of life can't be overestimated. If I took a couple of hundred New Yorkers onto a mountain where I live and we ran around without dogs trying to gather the flock, we'd fail miserably. But if I take three dogs, I can do it.
New York dog lovers might want to know whether your dogs sleep in your bed with you.
No, actually they don't. My dogs have very, very nice kennels, but they live in the barn. And I think they're happier there. They're absolutely work dogs. They don't really like being spoiled or having sort of being sentimentalized. So when people come to my farm, they want to make a fuss of the dogs, and the dogs are fairly indifferent. They're just looking for the next job, and that's what they love. They get a buzz from that.
You have a section in the book called How to Speak Sheepdog. So maybe those visitors should learn a little sheepdog language.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is my sheepdogs think I'm the leader of their pack, the lead wolf, if you like. And they live for the things that they think they're meant to be on the earth to do, which is to round things up, to bring them into the pens, to stop when they're told. And they're really happy, actually, when you see that they've learned all of those things. They know exactly what their role in the world is, and they're doing it every day. They're really fit. They're an environment they understand and that's good for them, and they're incredibly healthy. So it's a good life for them and a good life for me, too. I'm very lucky.
Before you leave, you mentioned that you were an American history major, yet this is the first time you've been in the United States. Has anything surprised you?
One little thing just surprised me. About an hour ago, I went to Central Park, and I feel like I've watched on TV and in movies my whole life Central Park, but it's 100 times more beautiful than I thought it would be. When the sun was coming through the leaves, sort of fall leaves this morning, I was amazed by how beautiful that place is. And I think if I ever spent... I probably won't because I've got to go home and look after my flock. But if I spent more time in New York, I'd spend a lot of it in the green spaces, on the High Line, in the Central Park, those kind of places. I love those.
You know one of them is called the Sheep's Meadow.
I do. I'm going to go to the Sheep's Meadow. I'm going to be really disappointed if there isn't a brilliant flock of sheep in the Sheep's Meadow.
No sheep there. I'm sorry. A lot of sheepish people, though. James Rebanks, his latest book, The Shepherd's View, Modern Photographs from an Ancient Landscape, published by Flatiron Books. It's been a great pleasure having you on our show.
It's been a joy to be here and a privilege. Thank you very much, and thank you to your listeners.